Lisa Christine is an adventurer, humanitarian, and fine art photographer. She has taken both some of the most devastating, but as well beautiful photos you're ever likely to see. She recorded a couple of years ago now an incredibly moving TED Talk about her work photographing modern slavery. It is an absolute must view, compendium to this podcast, and it's linked in the description. Her work has also been featured all over the globe. She sells internationally. She's completely independent. She is a superstar photographer. This episode is best consumed alongside Matthew Friedman, episode 152. Together, these two episodes reveal the shocking reality of modern day slavery. Because the reality is that there are more people right now who are slaves than ever has been before in our species history, and barely anyone knows about it. But this isn't a podcast to depress you. Rather, I hope that through Lisa, this podcast will be something that instead fills you with energy. Because it's not like you and I can really do much about this situation, except be well informed, or at least be as well informed as possible. And understanding Lisa's work, understanding Matthew's work, will bring you all the way up to the line to know what is happening at the moment. And then, should you decide to really do something about it, then that's an incredible next step. So as always, refer to the timestamps to navigate the conversation. If you wanted to say, just jump directly to Lisa, just jump directly to the modern slavery, leave a 5-star review on whatever platform it is that you are listening to this. The goal is to hit 200 by year end. So check your phone right now and see where you're at. If we're sub 2, leave 5. If we're post 2, leave 5. But also Lisa's website, which is her whole portfolio, she's completely independent. And if you have, I don't know, some sneaky disposable income lying around, I couldn't think of a better way than to buy one of her prints. So check that out 100%. And with absolutely no further ado, here is the great Lisa Christine. You first left the US when you were 18. Now, more than 112 countries later, and having barely slowed down, how do you think travel has changed in your lifetime?
Well, I'll tell you as a photographer what's changed. For so many years, you know, I've used a 4x5 view camera and, you know, these big sheets of film. And it's much harder now to travel with film because you have to go through such scrutiny at checkpoints, right? Like when you go through TSA and security around the world. And what that requires of me is to bring a translator in, get special permission so that they could walk me through the security so I can protect my film. That's what's changed. I think travel is amazing. One other thing that I'll touch upon is, you know, my work is from over 150 countries, actually.
Wow.
And it used to be sort of like I would drop into a place and it was just me and these spectacular, amazing humans. And because the world has gotten so much smaller vis-a-vis our, iPhones, etc., people are everywhere. There is very few stones unturned, so to speak, in the notion of travel. And now I feel like going to these faraway places, it's for me a little bit diluted. And what would concern me most about that is the idea that people who are living their lives close to the earth and in these small communities where their culture is intact in remote places are being, to some degree, unintentionally exploited by visitors and everybody making photographs with their iPhone or cameras, no different than myself, but different. So I'm not saying I have a right above anyone else because that's foolish and silly. But that to me is a little concerning, and I don't know what will happen to these people when they're reliant upon money that they get from tourists or whatever it is, how that will change their culture. So that's how I think it's changed.
Can you give an example, firsthand experience of how the world has gotten smaller?
Yeah. I mean, the world has gotten smaller in my mind definitively because of technology and the ability to discover so easily and to share discoveries so easily. And that's a wonder and a marvel, and it's so cool. And on the counter side of that, in our dualistic universe, you know, it's also, I think, less discoverable as someone that arrives into that situation and intimately is in the face of people living elsewhere and getting to know them. I think there's two sides of the coin, like there are in all things, you know.
No, totally. It doesn't necessarily have to be a judgment on whether it's good or bad.
Totally.
Of the places you revisit, how many of them feel the same versus how many of them feel like they've changed?
Well, it's funny. We could take an example of India. India is somewhere I've been going all my life. I mean, I've probably spent 3.5-4 years there cumulatively, you know, over many trips. And that place has drastically changed on the one hand. You know, technology is... has such vigor there, and there's been a lot of changes. And yet, at the same time, India has the spirit of India. And outside of those locales where, you know, those modernities are so present, it still has that magic. I think India's, for me, just, it's such a special place. I've learned so much there, and yeah. That's like a good example to me of a place that has changed, but on the other hand, hasn't, you know? And then you have somewhere like Ethiopia, which is really lovely. And in the southern area where there's these beautiful and very remote tribes, very challenging to get to. I mean, I used to go there and it would take quite a long time in a 4x4, and we would have to change tires regularly because they would just burst on the rocks and the stones. And now, you know, they built a big road through there. And I promise that that has forever changed the face of those people. And, you know, the ability to be visited more frequently.
Do you sort of lament the change a little bit? Is there a part of you that wishes some of these cultures could have stayed untouched and therefore influenced by the rest of the world?
Yes, sure, in some ways. And in some ways, no. You know, it's kind of like if you take somewhere like Tibet, where, you know, there's these beautiful yak clothing that is now replaced by North Face jackets. So, right? So the beauty is these people have access, as you and I do, to getting a North Face jacket, so to speak. And in lieu of that, what happens is the culture of their traditional amazing clothing goes to the wayside. So again, it's just kind of that two sides of the coin, you know?
Yeah, that is actually something that really stands out to me from Salgado's photos in the freelance gold mine back in the 80s. Obviously, you know the photos. I think if the audience doesn't, I'll leave links to them. But they are, in my opinion at least, some of the most striking photos you could ever see. It's unbelievable. And thinking about it when I looked at it, that's in the 80s, but it is a feeling that it could have been BC when these photos were taken. But that same setup today would be marked by a bunch of guys wearing cheap Chinese football jerseys, you know, or flip-flops of a bunch of different plastics, and therefore wouldn't have the same just sheer scale of history informing the photo.
That's true, and I'll add to that, that when you make an image in black and white, what you do is you sort of strip the image of time in a way, so that things appear like you wouldn't notice a football jersey or a, you know, something striking like a Texas Dallas Cowboys t-shirt as much in color as you would in, you know, in black and white, it would be much more subdued. So I always find that very interesting with using black and white, which strips away a lot of what we otherwise would see and be able to tie to a certain time. Do you know what I mean?
I wonder whether you have an opinion on what the most consequential photograph you've ever taken is.
Consequential photograph. I have made so many images that have consequence. Very distinctly around modern day slavery, you know, working on the front lines of modern day slavery, where, you know, I'm photographing people that are immersed still in an utterly controlled environment, and they themselves have no control over their lives and are slaves. Making a photograph of somebody in order to tell a story, in order to have a societal impact, is both very important and also can be viewed as, you know, I'm using the human being, so to speak, not that I'm using them, but that human being in the photograph, by virtue of being in the photograph, is a part of that story. And so I think there are consequences to that. And it's important to be mindful of those. And it's also weighing out, you know, what the most important goal is, I think. I think the idea that when I began this work some 16 years ago, I think it is now, on distinctly on photographing modern day slavery, you know, nobody knew that it existed. I mean, like myself, I knew of trafficking, but not that there were millions of people. And today that number is 50 million people that are enslaved around the world. These are brothers and sisters of yours and mine, you know. And that is largely made aware by virtue of a photograph versus a story versus a statistic. When you can see an image, you have a visceral response, and that visceral response arrives from the human being that is in that photograph, right? So that's consequential.
Totally. There was a movie called Sold, where an actress played the part of you. So the reason I bring that up is I was tagging onto what you said there about how an image might do more to move the needle in terms of awareness versus a great article or a great book or whatever. Is a great photograph the biggest needle mover, just in terms of how quickly someone can be made aware of something?
That's a really big question. So I believe that a photograph has the ability to transcend language. Words have a transcend, you know, words have a real strong power as well. But a photograph is visceral. And so my whole way of making an image, especially on the front lines of modern day slavery, is seeing somebody in a really, you know, challenging situation, but really, you know, focusing on their dignity. And what that allows for in my mind is the ability for a viewer at a later time to stand in front of that image and be connected to that dignity, and therefore feel a visceral connection and opportunity to want to do something to help. I think photography has that, because seeing is believing. You can hear a story, but it could be like a tale. But when you see something, I think that there's just so many you know, proponents of the brain that go off, and it has that heartfelt strength. It sort of draws us out of our head and into our heart. And when we are making decisions or being called upon from that space, I think there's a lot more power.
Away from your own photography, what are some photos that stand out in history as having achieved that?
Oh, wow. There's so many amazing photographs that have had that.
That is in your gut right now that comes straight to the top.
The one that's in my gut is there's an image of a Vietnamese monk during the Vietnam War that had ignited himself on fire in protest of the war. It was, I'm trying to think of the photographer, but in any case, that photograph, of course, got picked up on the news, and it was on the cover of many newspapers around the world, and eventually made its way to the White House, where, you know, Kennedy decided to take a total different posturing on Vietnam. That was based off an image. Like, if somebody's a monk who's utterly and completely about, you know, peace, is igniting himself on fire, willing to endure in a lotus position while he's burning, I mean, wow, That's a powerful image that I'll never be able to get out of my head since I saw it when I was young, you know?
I'm trying to think of one myself, but the only one that's coming to mind is the Afghan girl with the blue eyes. But that's actually got quite a fraught history as well, I think.
How so?
Isn't it the case that the person who took that photo had been expressly asked to not publish it?
Oh, I don't know the story. I don't.
Well, I also could just be spreading fake news, so we'll leave that there.
No, it's very possible. I mean, if it was made in a refugee camp and the person is a minor, although that was a really long time ago that photograph was made, so I don't know if such laws would appeal, but it's possible.
But it is one of the most distressing realities of the world right now that there are more slaves today by sheer numbers than has ever been in history. So I wanted to ask if you could explain how it's possible that one ends up as a slave in the year 2023.
Well, sadly, it's extremely easy to fall into slavery. And I should say that nobody falls into slavery and human trafficking because they're stupid. They do so because they've been lied to and they've been exploited. So it often happens by virtue of often somebody that somebody knows via a family member or someone else who's very cunning and has the ability to say, hey, you know, I have a job for you, or a better job, or I'm going to offer you an education, or I'm going to put your child through school and all they have to do is help out around the house. They'll come live with my aunt. And what happens once that person is removed from their immediate familiar territory is, you know, their identity cards, if they even have any, are taken, and they are hasped away, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles to a place where, you know, nobody's going to know them and they have no agency or power, especially a young person. And they are forced to do whatever that trafficker wishes, which there's a whole plethora of things that people do when they're under the hand of a trafficker, but it's deeply distressing.
So that's an example, say, in the home. Take us to Southeast Asia, where you spend so much time, where the majority of the slavery is. How could it be the case that entire families are in generational slavery?
Well, a lot of slavery, of course, is born from poverty, but that does not exempt somebody who's of middle class in the United States to be trafficked. So I want to be clear about that. But when people are very poor and often not educated, and say someone gets sick in the family, or, you know, like somebody has to borrow money to, like, $20 for a doctor bill. Well, a trafficker who's appearing as your best friend is going to lend that money and say, and, you know, it's even better is you can work for me and pay it back. That's how you have, you know, indentured servitude and bonded labor is people fall into these false, you know, impermissive agreements where the interest rate is really high and they're not educated. They don't know that they're being exploited. You can have entire families be, you know, enslaved over generations so that the new generation who inherits that debt, that's their way of life. So they don't even know they're enslaved, if that makes sense. They're living their life as they would, you know, anyone else would, with their environment showing them who they are. And that's like a real danger. So you can have entire villages that are enslaved, and it's real activists that do fine work on the ground that are able to educate people of their rights and help them get out of that dire situation.
And also, just to be clear, you know, we're not talking about being ripped off or being taken advantage of for a low price. It's literally your passport is taken, you are not allowed to leave, and at the threat of violence, you're going to work. Like, it is that type of slavery.
Yes, and there's no longer a need really for chains, if you will, as we often think about slavery with chains in the 1800s, but it's really chains of the mind. You know, there is an utter threat of violence, and if it's not against you as a victim, it's against your family if you dare to not obey, go kill your mother or, you know, family. And, you know, those are pretty easy ways to control people, and it's deeply distressing.
I mean, your first TED Talk is both one of the most distressing videos I've ever seen, but as well, just one of the most necessary, I would say. I don't know if that's too pompous to say, but it's an amazing thing. You're talking about how a photo can sort of bring awareness to someone, and everyone listening to this should as well watch that YouTube, that TED Talk. It's going to be in the description. It's phenomenal. But how do you then explain why there is such, even with your photos, many other great documentations of it, how there is still such a general unawareness of slavery? Just to give you a very biased data point, I'm here in Stockholm. I'm surrounded by, in my office, extremely well-educated people, kind, good people. None of them had any idea that there is such a thing as modern-day slavery. They assumed on the margin it happens. I mean, we've all seen Taken with Liam Neeson, but it's, you know, it almost sounds like a lie to say there is more slavery now than there ever has been before. So with all that, just how do you explain the general lack of awareness?
Well, there's two things. One is there's that belief that it was already taken care of in the 1800s, right? There's that definitive belief. So nobody's looking for it. And because of that and the ignorance of it, you know, slavery can hide in plain sight. It could be the person that's serving you at the restaurant that you go to. So that when you think you're tipping somebody and they're getting that tip, well, no, they're not getting paid at all, actually. It could be the person in a kiosk at a gas station. It could be a maid in somebody's house. It could be the person that you believe to be a prostitute in the red light district. They, you know, it could be all these things where the assumption is that they're there on their own free will and that they're being paid. So I think that's a large part of it. I remember being in Ghana and I was documenting child slavery on the fishing villages of Lake Volta. It's like the largest man-made lake in the world. And initially going down there with these, abolitionists, these activists who brought me into these situations, I remember I wanted to get a lay of the land, so we went down to the beach, and I saw this, you know, beautiful family out fishing. I mean, I said, oh man, that's so nice to do on a Sunday or something, whatever it was. And he very quickly looked at me and he said, no, Lisa, that is not a family out fishing. Those young kids are slaves and the older ones remain slaves. And they were taken when they were young and now they're managing the young ones. But any passerby would have no idea of that, right? So this is how it occurs. It's happening in all of our vicinities, no matter where we are, in pretty, you know, intimate distances from where we are. This is why awareness building is so important. This is why, you know, it used to be when I started this work, the reason I started it is kind of what you were just saying about not realizing the extensive nature of slavery and human trafficking. And that's why I started it, because I had no idea. And I thought, well, if I don't know, how many other people don't know? So the more that we can get it out in front of people, and it has to be pretty constant and it has to be pretty direct, then the more power we have, you know?
Are you familiar with Mikey Mistrati?
I am not.
Danish journalist and has done, has pretty much committed the last 10 years of his life to the chocolate supply chain and identifying, all the lies embedded in there. And he has this distressing experience where he's gone to West Africa multiple times. Every time he goes, within a few days, he's having a first-hand interview with someone who's not only child labor being taken advantage of, but they were kidnapped from some neighboring village. They have attempted to escape several times, been beaten for trying, taken back, and given the worst jobs with each incremental time. Every single time he went, which can't just be a coincidence. In other words, it's evidence of slavery within the chocolate supply chain. You just give evidence within whether it's a fishing supply chain for that local economy or whatever. But it is mind-boggling just how prevalent it is. How is it the case that with all the evidence of it occurring, not more is done about it? There's a missing piece here.
Yeah, well, part of it, I think, is it's the not knowing for general public. And that's frustrating, but it's just the truth. And the other thing is that, you know, all of us, you and I included, are all right now wearing something that has slavery in it. We're using technology right now that has slavery in it. If I want to be a green good citizen and I go get my solar panels, well, there's a lot of slavery in solar panels. There's slavery on almost every paint job, on every car. I mean, it is in everything. And I think that, you know, we are in the Western world, a society that doesn't want to pay a lot of money for our lovely gadgets and things that we have. Not to say that slavery doesn't exist in expensive things, because it does. It exists in everything. But there's a price to a slave-free world. And that price would be an increase in what we pay for virtually everything, which I believe that if everybody believed that they could eradicate it to whatever deal, they would probably pay more, right? Whatever, 15, 20% more, whatever it is. But it's in everything, you know. It's such a big topic.
But even if, I mean, you and I can't claim ignorance that there is potentially slavery in most chocolate bars. I still eat chocolate. So it's like...
a lot of food.
I think there is a pretty depressing reality to front up with, which is just that if the consumer, me, is far enough removed from the crime, you're sort of unwilling to change your behavior a little bit. So
that kind of
has to happen locally, right? I mean, how much slavery is happening in India? Why is this not more of a source of shame for the country on the international stage? I'm thinking things along these lines.
Right. Well, I want to be clear here, because slavery is illegal in every country, and yet it exists in pretty much every country. And if you take a country like India or any other where slavery is occurring, shame is not going to win the game, in my opinion. I think we have to invite every country in a global family to all together work on removing slavery, because the shame is what prevents people from even looking at it and wanting to change it. There's too much embarrassment. So I believe that, and this is just my personal belief, but the shame has to be removed, and what has to come in place of it is an acceptance and an ability to start, removing it from the supply chains. And I'm not, you know, and from people's countries, but I'm not saying there shouldn't be accountability or anything like that. I just think shame is a, it's not a good way to get things done personally.
So if your photos are bringing awareness to this and therefore driving towards some type of stopping of it, how do you get access in the first place? I mean, you must be the very last person that a slave lord is going to let into their little kingdom.
Yeah, my work would never be possible without partners on the ground that are working undercover as abolitionists in those communities. Those are people that are very educated about slavery and that are, you know, really working with the people, very quietly. So they really are, you know, my guardians, my translators, and they're the ones that bring me in. So if you take this body of work, which is probably amongst the largest body of work on modern day slavery in the world, almost all of it made in so many countries was made in little like 10-minute, 15-minute segments because of the lack of safety. They don't, you know, welcome me in. It has to be, it's very challenging and quick. And it's, I have people around me on different perimeters watching out for my safety, and somebody right beside me that can tap me and say, we got to go.
Okay. So you've been almost smuggled in there. Like the people who run the place have no idea that, you know, here's Lisa Christine, world famous photographer. She's about to blow the lid on this whole thing. They've got no idea.
No.
Okay. Have you ever had to face repercussions once you've left?
I have not had to. I mean, I've had short calls on site in some places for sure, but once I've left, it's been okay, you know. It's been okay. I feel very grateful for having been in so many dangerous and precarious situations. I mean, the work is very perilous. It's not safe. And it's intense. And I feel extremely grateful that I have not had any, you know, direct harm come to me. And I'm acutely aware of that and grateful for it.
Yeah, totally. How powerful is the guilt that you feel when you're there photographing these people, full well knowing that it's out of your hands whether you can change their situation or not?
Yeah, guilt is such a powerful word, and I don't think it's a useful feeling, although we feel it. I remember being in the brick kilns the first time I was photographing slavery on the front lines, and like you said, with the Salgado photographs, it felt like I was, you know, back in ancient Egypt, or Dante's Inferno for that matter. And I'll never forget these old, very fragile people that were stooped over, caked in brick dust, and carrying this enormous weight on their backs and their heads, and it was very intense, and I actually started to cry. And just a little tear. And the abolitionist next to me shook me, and he's like, "Lisa, no way. You cannot do that here. It is not safe. It's not helping you. It's not helping them. You got to get out of that space." And I was, in that instant, I really saw that, to speak to the word guilt, you know, what I had the ability to do was to do some action. And my action was really about making the photographs in order to shine a light on the issue. And then to recognize that those abolitionists, those activists that are working so wholeheartedly on ground are the ones really directly helping these people. And they have the expertise and the know-how to do so, wherein I may do something that I think is correct to help them, but maybe that would really screw things up for them, right? This is often the case. So, you know, I think all of us, no matter what, we can all do our part, you know, to help this situation. Just as a notion, you are someone who does these brilliant podcasts, so you have the ability to speak with folks like me and others that are involved in this particular atrocity to raise awareness, you know, amplified in fashion, you know. And I think that's the way that we deal with not having guilt, but having a more fulfilled life, is by, you know, taking a little piece of meaning and doing something with it in whatever way we can, as an attorney, as a photographer, as an actor for some, or a podcast host, right? So that's my thought around it.
What about the emotional toll that doing this work has taken on you?
Well, back to that point when I first had that emotional experience, I very quickly put that away in a file. And so I would deal with that sadness mostly when I was back in the studio and editing the work, you know, looking at everything. And then I could kind of deal with my feelings. But of course, my overall arching work is, you know, it's not just about modern day slavery. That's just a little bit under that umbrella. And the larger bit is about documenting all over the world to really inspire unity and dignity. And therein is a tremendous amount of beauty. I mean, when I'm done working with elders in a day, you know, in some, you know, Amazonian tribe or something, I often will kneel at the elders' feet and just gaze in their eyes. And, you know, those moments of transference and beauty, they're so incredible. There is so much wonder in this world, and there is so much beauty. And, you know, I have learned through seeing a lot of the dark underbelly of the world that it can really get to my soul. It can be very scary because it's so organized and it's so powerful and it's very dark and violent. But there's also this other beauty and awe-inspiring wonder that we have in our world. And I think it's important for me to balance them out. You know,
there's a lot of spiritual undertones in the way you speak. Are you religious?
I am not religious. No, I'm not religious.
No worries. Forgive me if that was a little bit rude.
No, I deal so much with different religions all the time. I'm fascinated by theology, but mostly I'm fascinated with how we all find meaning. And so,
what's your worldview when it comes to how one finds meaning in a godless world?
Well, what I see are there's many pathways to the same place. That's all I see. I have no sense of urgency about religion and what that would mean for me. That's not my path. My path is just seeing the overall ways in which we find meaning, and that I just think it's an amazing experience to be alive. And I think that whether there's hardship, challenge, or ease and success, that all of them work together and that we're constantly growing. And to me, it's definitely about unifying people and not dividing, if that makes sense.
No, the reason I just asked, because you made a really interesting comment at the end there, saying that you're just trying to find meaning. And I just wonder whether you have any type of unified worldview for instance, is there an inherent meaning to our lives? Do we just find it ourselves? And if so, are there consequences? I know I'm really catching you off guard here. We didn't prepare to speak about this, but just in case something comes to mind.
No worries. I don't recall saying that I'm searching for meaning, but I will say that, everybody has their own path. Everybody has their own path. The way that I see life is that there's a tremendous amount of meaning. And so I take every obstacle or challenge or opportunity as an amplification of that path. That's how I take it. But someone else may not, A cigar is just a cigar. I have no idea. It's just my path.
Yeah, love it. And you've sort of hinted at it in a few of your interviews, potentially dabbling. You spent a bunch of time in a cave, a silent cave, dark cave. What's the longest period of time you've spent in silence and in a dark room, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, that was when I was much younger, and I had time to do such wonderful things. I studied Vipassana, and so my longest stint was 30 days. And it was pretty tremendous, actually. It was really amazing.
30 days in silence, and how else were you deprived? You couldn't see people? You were literally in a cave?
Well, actually, those particular retreats were 30-day retreats, and the last seven were in cloistered cells. So they were in very small confines of darkness, half the size of a closet at night, and certainly maybe like 3 by 3 feet, and they close the door and you sit there in total darkness.
Wow.
Yeah, it's intense. And it was, you go to bed early, wake up at like 4 a.m, have a meditation, have a small breakfast, go into a room with others, but nobody's speaking. You don't make eye contact. It's very solo experience. And it's definitely about being with what is occurring, being with what is present, and it can be really challenging. But it's amazing because you could have this tremendous discomfort, right? This physical discomfort or a mental discomfort. And because you cannot move, so to speak, you choose not to move, it's always amazing to watch how it will leave. Something else will take its place, And that's kind of a big gift, right? I should go back and do it again. I used to do those things. I had more time.
What did that do for you, 30 days of silence?
I think it gave me a lot more strength in myself, because even though in 30 days of silence is a long time, and there's a lot of questions and doubts and things that come up, maybe things from one's past. I mean, it's it's think we have 60,000 thoughts a day, right? So imagine all these things when you can't say anything, you can't communicate. And I think what I got out of it was, even though I had a longing to want to ask a question and gain an answer, that ultimately the answers would arrive to me, you know, when I had no ability to reach out. And I think that's the biggest thing I learned.
You know? Phenomenal. To change direction, but not necessarily theme, you used this phrase in an interview, which I really loved. You were asked what you were looking for in an image, and you responded that you looked for a lived-in face.
Yeah, you know, as a photographer and a fine art photographer slash journalist, I work very much on instinct. So I go to what I'm drawn to. And usually that is always, that is a person, young or old, who has something that I see personally as, yeah, lived in face, or a sense of infinity about them, like something about their gaze, or I don't know, something to me that's really intriguing, you know?
I just thought it was such a brilliant turn of phrase, because it says so much, and I think I can, but I think most people would be able to recognize what you mean when you say a lived in face. Features, the gaze, maybe it's in the eyes, but I guess it's the whole package.
Yeah, in the wrinkles and the, you know, the imperfections and the perfection that comes from that and all that stuff.
Totally. What's a lived in face that stands out to you from your discography?
Well, I think of one woman who I made an image of, a nun. She was an elder in Cambodia. And I called that image Gift Within. And she's a woman with she's old, right? So she has this beautiful lined face, and she's bald with very, very short white hair and a white robe. And her sense of beauty and benevolence was really potent. And when I learned more about her, I'd learned that when she was younger, she had witnessed her entire family, you know, cut up with machetes by the Khmer Rouge. And yet she still had this, you know, she had still, you know, forgiven and had this sense of, I don't know, wholehearted living, I guess I would call it. And that's what I was drawn to, you know. I always say that the people I photograph are not my subjects, you know, they're really my mentors. I learn by their example of life. And yeah, that's very intriguing to me.
So I'm sure you're constantly sought out by budding photographers and adventurers and so forth. And as well, it's easy for us to just see the images you produce, the adventures you go on, and sort of project a romantic idea onto it. No one knows actually maybe how hard or how difficult it is until they do it themselves. But if someone were listening to this and they wanted to lead a life such as yours, what would you suggest they do?
Well, just do it. I mean, to me, the key to life is, if you have an interest in doing something, you have to pick it up and start doing it. It's not brain surgery. I'm not a proponent of, oh, you have to go to the best school of photography. Nothing like that. It's really get a camera, learn the basics, and start making photographs every day, and make notes every day, and then compare them with your results, and do it every day. And what arrives from that is a refinement of technique, but equally so, one's own vision, because we don't always know our vision when we start. It sort of evolves over time, and then when we look back on it, we see, oh, that's what my body of work will be like. It sort of becomes, it's not pushed, it arrives in its own time. But what needs to be, well, practices to me is, it's just that sense of occupying the space of doing what you love and making sure you do it all the time, you know?
So master the craft and serendipity will come?
I don't know. about what comes, but I can only, I don't know that everybody that's going to go out and make photographs every day and learn from them is going to be a photographer. I don't know, but something will come, you know. I don't know about serendipity, but sometimes it happens that way, right? Where these, I mean, I didn't intend at all to be a photographer, and here I am a photographer. My whole life's path is now carved by that. But I went to school to do fashion design, you know, and I'd always photographed, but somehow the photography, which I did anyway, alongside with writing and art, I've always been in the arts and music, that seemed to find its legs, because when I shared it, people responded to it, and then that would further, you know, have the impetus to keep going forward, and, you know.
I suppose what I'm trying to get at is more the nuts and bolts. You know, how do you support yourself? How do you make money? Where do you find income, projects? How do you think about your career as a photographer?
All right. Well, the nuts and bolts of it are really that how I survive is because I have clients who purchase my work. So I sell fine art photographs. And that allows me to go and make new bodies of work. It also allows me the ability to go do all this other stuff, like documenting slavery, so that I can, you know, support that that mission, if you will. It all comes from the selling of my work, and I do a lot of speaking as well. And activism through that, speaking at the UN or the Vatican or heads of state, TED Talks, whatever, you know. But really, it's about the artwork, if you will, and, you know, having an audience around the world that desires to purchase it. That's how I survive.
And are you intentional about promoting yourself? And these activities you do, which do promote your art and potentially find new clients through it?
I don't think I'm a person who does a lot of reaching out, you know. I don't go, oh wow, I want to be on TED, I'm going to fill out an application. Right. It happened that people started inviting me to do things, and you are right that once you do things, whether it's in print or on a big stage or whatever it is, that ends up, you know, you get to a lot more people who learn about you and so forth, you know. So it sort of, it definitely works like in a circular fashion, but I am never been one that is very active about reaching out to do those, to make those happen. It's more like they arrive and organic.
Serendipity. What's the price range for your top of the line stuff?
Oh gosh, they open up at $3,500 and they go up from there.
So with that being said, how do you think about artificial scarcity in number of editions per photo, pricing it, and so forth?
Well, I do limited edition photographs, right? So I do a lineup that's not very large. There's lots of photographers that do large editions of, you know, 900, 3,000. Lots of people that don't number their work. And, you know, there's so many ways to go about it, but my way's pretty traditional and pretty straightforward, you know. I suppose it does make it scarce because there's only X amount. But having said that, once something, you know, finishes, then it's done. There's no more.
I'm just curious, the economics behind it. What thought goes into how many editions am I going to print of this one? In your case, it's very few, but then how am I going to price it? Are you searching for sort of maximum profitability, or are you thinking, I want these to be sort of exclusive and maybe then the client can have a higher resale value on them down the line and so forth? And forgive me if this is like the ugly economics of photography. It's just, I'm very intrigued by it.
I don't generally talk about this, to be fair, but I can say that pricing, any artist that prices their work, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, but I think it's utterly arbitrary. It's utterly arbitrary. There's no, you know, I don't sit down and go, oh gosh, how many? I mean, I just have always done it in this particular way. It hasn't really changed at all. Mm. And I've followed that path. And I think that pricing one's work is it's just about pricing it. And if it sells, it sells. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. It's very simple. Mm. You know?
Love it. All right, Lisa, let's see if we can crack out a few quick ones before the time runs up on us.
Okay, go for it, Ryan.
Gut instinct, which country offers the most photographic bounty?
Oh, gosh. Everywhere offers photographic bounty. Go outside your home and start photographing.
If there was one country left, which would you choose? From a photographic perspective.
That I haven't been to?
No. I'm trying to get you to say which is the best country to for photographic opportunity.
Oh, well, you know, a lot of people think India, and I think India is a good one because it's so full of color. People are very open, and it's just full of magic. I think India would be a great place.
We touched on Salgado earlier, but could you speak a little bit more about photographers you admire?
Well, the main photographer that I admire is Salgado. I love his work so much.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, I have a few Salgados myself. Another one is James Notchwe, who is a tremendous and astonishing photographer, very specifically of war and atrocities in order to wake us up to not do it anymore.
Is he still alive?
He is still alive. He's got a beautiful, very large, handsome book called Inferno, and it will break your heart. And it's just tremendous. But those two, to me, have always been just super impactful and have really resonated with utter power, right? Mm. Like, the power of an image is born in those photographers' work, for sure.
Yeah. Salt of the Earth is potentially like a top three movie of all time for me.
So beautiful. So beautiful. And then the whole element of his family, you know, in Brazil and replanting that forest that had gone, you know, it was basically eliminated, right? And when they replanted it, how all the wildlife came back and the birds and because that to me is the bigger story of his work, if you will, you know, like there are these challenges that we have in the world, but if we can bend it, you know, then we have the ability to rebuild and do something better. And I really just am so inspired by that.
Have you met him before?
I haven't met him before, which is kind of crazy.
What's going on? Yeah.
I'm sure, I don't know what his life is like, but I'm sure it's busy, and I am, you know, busy.
Lisa, we gotta make that happen. I've been in the DMs of, I don't know, every feasible person who would potentially manage him, trying to get him on.
I'm
holding
great.
On to it that one day. Yeah, exactly. I think actually, might sound hyperbolic, but I think he's my number one dream guest and has been for a while.
I love it. I think that's such a great choice.
Yeah. Because obviously his photographs are going to live on forever as this incredible contribution. But him as a bloke is so interesting.
Yeah.
Like, he was, I forget how old, he just had his first kid. Then he just takes off on like a 5-year road trip throughout northern Brazil. Like, this is an intriguing fella.
Yeah. And I think he's still married. Isn't he still married to that same woman? I can't remember.
Yeah, and she edits his photos.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What a fantastic partnership. He has such a distinct style in the editing.
Yeah, it's so lovely. Yeah, really moving.
How much time do you spend processing your typical image?
Whatever it takes, you know. It takes a while to get the printing down so that it's really, but once it's dialed in, then it becomes much swifter, right? And it's great. It's really feeling to me what the most potent image is going to be in choosing that. I'm not someone who makes a lot of images of one subject, if you will. So, you know, the person there going, I'm into like 1 to 3 is plenty to get the what I feel is the most authentic, but also that has that stirring quality. After that, I think it gets a little flat. So amongst all the different subjects that I make, it's just seeing which one really resonates. And one thing about my work is that I'll go out and do a very large body of work. Most photographers will say they go to, say, Brazil, like Salgado and he'll, not him, but someone will do a large body of work in Brazil and then release that body of work, right? I don't work that way. Interestingly, I pull out a few gems and then I may wait a year or 10 and I'll pull out another gem from that same thing. So it's not very linear. And I don't do a body of work at once because my work outside of modern day slavery is very much about unity, you know, inspiring unity. So I always incorporate pieces with other pieces, if that makes sense, from around the world. So it's a body of work, but it's not in, in that way, like as most people do it.
Nice. Australia, have you spent much time there?
No, I haven't spent much time there, but I have spent time there. And I want to do a project on the Aborigines. I think that would be really special.
Finally, two questions that I try to ask every guest. The first we've sort of chipped away at throughout the conversation, but it is, what is the role that serendipity has played in your life?
Well, lots. As an example, my beginnings, my childhood was kind of challenging, rough and tumble. And I have a memory of sitting in my living room at my mom's bookshelf, and she had these big anthropology books, and I would pull them out and look at these amazing photographs of people that were really covered in mud and feather and pigment. And I think from my childlike perspective that I saw them as utterly unshakable, right? They looked like they were part of the earth. And I remember walking out in the middle of my street and declaring that when I was old enough, I'd go find these people and learn what it was that they had so I could bring it into my own life.
That's amazing.
And it is amazing because then you fast forward. I was sent to be raised by my aunt and uncle, bless their hearts, who gave me my first camera. And like any kid, I used that camera, but I photographed, like many other kids, friends and family, but I was more interested in their sober spirit, like their, I don't know, just not the cheesy grin or modelly pose. It was very different. And I made tremendously bad black and white prints because I was just beginning. I was just a little wee one. But they're kind of priceless, you know? And then if I fast forward later to leaving the country after I'd studied design, like anybody else, I brought my camera. And, you know, what was born from those 5 years away, making photographs of my $2 a day of living, right? With the backpack on. I know you Australians understand that. what was born from that whole lineage is who I am today. And it is what my career is today. And it is, that to me is total serendipity, you know? You just think of all these little things that fall into place to, you know, where you finally are in a groove in the earth, that path, and you know that's your groove, you know, like I know what my purpose is, never, ever a question to me, ever. Mm.
That must be such a comfortable, powerful feeling to have.
Yeah, it's like that little bit of that nuclear space of just knowing. It's really cool.
What is a country that you're particularly bullish on going forward?
Tough on?
Bullish. Do you know what that means?
Translate to,
yes.
To American.
No, of course, of course. Basically, if you could, as you look across the world, what is a country that you think has a particularly bright future? and why?
Wow. That is a really good question that I don't feel like I have a really clear answer on.
What does your gut tell you?
Well, I'll say this, but again, I'm not entirely sure, but Bhutan is a very small kingdom locked in by these Himalayan mountains. And, you know, they instead of focusing on gross national product, instead focus on gross national happiness. And I think that sentiment is beautiful. That as a kingdom, you know, the royals, but also the democracy that they have there now is very much centered on that. Having said that, they have their issues. So, you know, but I think that having that sort of esteemed value is, you know, that character, that's to me very hopeful. Like America's very ambitious, you know, we're so cut out for individualism and capitalism. And there's a lot of really great things about that, but there are also equally harmful things and greedy things about that, right? So gross national happiness, man, that's pretty rad.
That is pretty cool. Well, Lisa, ever since I saw that TED Talk, I have been anticipating this podcast a lot, very highly. And I thank you so much for being generous with your time, generous with your responses. And I just can't say from the bottom of my heart, you take amazing photos. And that's incredible.
Thank you so much, Ryan.